They want me to get rid of my dog. Can they do that?
I'm being fined for leaving my garage door open too long.
What are covenants? Do I have any rights?
Help, I feel like I've left the American zone.
If you want the answers to those questions, join me, Sue Bartholomew, and my guests on The Commons every Saturday from 2 to 3 right here on WBR Fairfax Radio. We'll ask the experts and we'll untangle the truth about what's left of our property rights.
On the Commons is a weekly radio show dedicated to discussing the many issues surrounding mandatory membership homeowners associations. Join us as we explore this relatively new world of controlled living, which includes condominiums, cooperatives, and both attached and detached single-family homes. Living in a common ownership development means giving up the American dream. It means giving up your constitutional rights and control over your most valuable asset, your home. Living in a homeowners association means leaving the American zone. This is On the Commons, and I am Sue Bartholomew.
Joining me on the Commons today, I have an old friend who doesn't remember me at all, unfortunately, but Robert Nordland's coming to us from sunny California. Thank you, Robert.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be with you today.
I have to tell you that it's really rainy and nasty over here, so I'm glad you're sitting in the sun and enjoying the weather.
Well, I'm in the office working, so that's the kind of things someone has to do.
Apparently so, yes. So I want to introduce you to my listeners. You are the founder and CEO of Association Reserves, and you know a whole lot about reserves across the country. And we'll talk a little bit about what reserves are, and we're going to talk a little bit primarily, I think, about the financial health of associations. And associations are homeowner associations, condominiums, co-ops, and timeshares, and anything else?
Well, we see dockominiums, we see parkominiums. It's fun to see so many different forms of co-ownership out there, but they all face the same issues and the same challenges.
Dockominiums?
Dockominiums.
What on earth is a dockominium?
It's a slip that you buy where you can put your boat.
So it's a dock, basically.
It's a boat slip, yes.
It's a boat
slip. So rather than renting a slip at a marina, you purchase a slip and own title to it and can sell it just like you could a condominium.
So all of these we're looking at special assessment, or we're looking at assessments, membership assessments.
Membership assessments, yeah, they're basically association-governed communities of one form or another.
Wow, you must be busy.
There's a lot of them out there.
Oh, my goodness. All right, well, you've taught me something already, and we're not even into 5 minutes yet. So thank you for that. So what is the financial health of all of these associations across the country?
Well, it's pretty much boils down to human nature, but there's a parameter, a measuring tool in the reserve study world called percent funded. It measures the reserve fund strength compared to the deterioration at the association. It's a very neutral measurement, but it clearly shows if the association is on pace collecting the money that they need to collect to provide for the needs of the association, or if they're behind. And what we find is that about 70% of associations across the country of all types in all locations are about 70% of associations across the country are underfunded. And again, no real surprise, these associations are led by humans who pay the assessments themselves, and they're a little reluctant to raise assessments. But the bottom line is about 70% of associations across the country are underfunded. That leaves about 30% that are doing a fantastic job.
So when you say underfunded, is it the collection, or is it because the associations themselves are not able to balance what they're collecting? Because you have, basically, you usually have two different accounts. One of them is the operating budget, and that budget goes to pay the ongoing expenses. And then you have the reserve budget, the reserve account, where you put money into the reserve. Sometimes they just throw in anything that's left over and
right.
don't budget for it. So is it because they're not collecting, or is it because they're not able to budget accurately? Is it because they're not able to manage the operating budget? What seems to be the problem? I mean, wanting more money is, I mean, everybody wants more money.
Right.
And
right.
there's just so much of it. So what's the real problem? What's the real issue? What can we do to make this balance out a little better?
Well, I think you've hit on the core of the issue. Anytime there's scarcity, there's tension, it's difficult. It causes people to wring their hands and get perhaps defensive. But there's in my comments today, I'll be speaking primarily about the reserve fund. That's my area of expertise, so I won't be able to speak too much about the operating fund. And I'll wave my hand at delinquencies and say that while we saw delinquencies across the country go up when we went through our latest economic crisis, delinquencies seem to be down to a more manageable level from what I hear from managers across the country. Again, so let's not talk about collections. I think that's somewhat stable at this point in time. But primarily what I see are associations, and again, I mentioned 70% of them, have not collected enough funds to keep pace with the ongoing deterioration that's all around them at the association. So there's a few elements to that. One is that there's a lack of knowledge. The boards don't know or aren't facing the truth of the financial needs of the association. They're optimistically budgeting. And number two, because of that, they're perhaps lacking the courage to face the truth. And if they do get a reserve study, or if they do learn that 9 out of the last 10 years they've had a certain level of snow removal expenses or whatever it is at their association, they're not facing that truth. But I think perhaps most importantly, they're pursuing the wrong objective. There's been a culture in our country of boards trying to minimize homeowner assessments, thinking that's a good thing. But like any living organism, I see a community association as a living organism. It needs, literally needs money and people to function. And if you take away either or limit either, it's not going to thrive. And there's too many associations out there that are trying to get by on inadequate cash, and they're just fooling themselves. It leads to budgets being tight. It leads to reserves being underfunded. It leads to special assessment. It leads to tension and political turmoil. There's a lot of bad things that happen when an association budgets optimistically, and they willfully aren't collecting enough cash. Again, it may be a lack of knowledge, it may be lack of courage, but I think most of the time it's just they are literally pursuing the wrong objective. They're not providing for the needs of the association. They're just trying to keep assessments low.
Let's go back to the people who are paying the assessments.
Yeah.
And these are the people who have jobs and they're on limited incomes, and they also have budgets, and they also have expenses that they have to cover. So their money is not unlimited. In fact, salaries and income across the board for the last umpteen years has gone way, way down. So what happens when something like that happens? They have to tighten their belts. They have to get creative. They have to find different ways of making ends meet. They just can't go into this pool. I mean, remember, associations have this incredible power where they can actually foreclose and take your home away if you don't pay. So should associations also try to be creative and tighten their belts and figure out how to make do with what they have, as opposed to just consistently increasing assessments?
Certainly. Shu, the board members have, as you know, have a responsibility to maintain, enhance, and protect the the assets of the corporation. That's their job. It's their job to maintain the corporation on behalf of the homeowners and in the best interest of the homeowners. Sometimes that means the association needs more income, and sometimes that means the association needs to judiciously trim expenses. And so it's a combination of the two.
Okay.
But I think there's been, again, a culture of developers underestimating the true costs of an association. And they'll lure buyers in with the promise of a carefree lifestyle. How many times have we heard that?
Oh, yes. Isn't that a nice one, right?
Yeah. Carefree lifestyle where everything's taken care of, and the developer says, and you can have all of this for $150 a month. And the association opens its doors, and 6 months later they realize that there's absolutely no way they can pay the bills with $150 per unit per month. So they have been started from the beginning. Again, it's in the developer's best interest to sell homes, and the way they sell homes is by being optimistic. So almost can't blame them. It's just the nature of what they do. But then boards for years and years and years are trying to catch up, and of course they have to raise assessments faster than inflation to catch up, because the assessments were were set too low, artificially low to start with. And so, yeah, it's painful on the homeowners. It would have been a whole lot better if, well, like when you go into a automobile lot and you see the stickers on the window saying the estimated gas mileage is 32 miles a gallon or 16 miles a gallon. It would be great if the homeowner assessments were set accurately, so homeowners could say, I can or I cannot afford the homeowner assessments here, just as easily as they can say, I can afford only a $350,000 condo. I can't afford a $450,000 condo. So it's a little bit of inappropriate expectations, and people, unfortunately, getting lured in above their heads, and they didn't even know it.
I live in an association that was started in the late 60s sometimes. So it's an older one. And like a lot of the older associations, the governing documents are really much, much slimmer than the modern ones, the newer ones. And there's a cap on our assessments. We do have the authority to charge a special assessment. As far as I know, we've never done that in all these years. And the cap is tied to the Consumer Price Index, the CPI. So when there's times of high inflation, people's income generally goes up. Everything costs more, and we're able to raise the assessments. And at times when it's flat or it doesn't move or it goes like less than 1% or 2%, then that's pretty much what we're allowed to raise. And it's working. I mean, it's not a small association. It's quite large. And for all these years, I don't know how many years, it's still working. But I don't think you have caps on associations and on assessments anymore, do you, Robert? Have you seen them?
Well, we see them, and when we come up with a client that does have a cap, if they still do have a cap, an annual cap on that limits their increases, we recommend it's something that they incorporate next time they update their governing documents, because caps are very tough. They make it, as you say, they tie the board's hands and prevent them from giving the association the cash that it needs to survive. It really limits their ability to, perhaps as the neighborhood changes, add security services, upgrade something, or deal with a catastrophic event, or just there's some operational expenses, as I understand, that for one reason or another rise faster than the pace of inflation. And so our recommendation is always get rid of that cap next time they update their governing documents. It's a very limiting factor.
See, this is where you and I disagree. I think you see a cap as the glass being half full or half empty, and I see it as being half full. Having been on the board and having been on the finance committee, I know it can be juggled. I'm not saying it's easy, and I'm not saying it doesn't come with its own challenges. But life is full of challenges, and you know, sometimes you just have to deal with what you have. And we've managed to work through all of that. I mean, we've got 1,300 homes, two-thirds townhouses to a third single-family homes. We've got a lake, a pond, four tennis courts, two swimming pools, and over 100 acres of common land. We own our own streets, except for in the single-family homes. And we've managed. I mean, it's doable.
Yeah, it may be doable, and you are to be complimented, or your association is to be complimented. But from my point of view, that's a restriction that just makes it very hard for the board of directors to do the job that they have been assigned and that they have a legal responsibility to accomplish, and that's to maintain, protect, and enhance the assets of the corporation. And it's tough to do when the board before you was a little light on setting the assessments, and the board before it was a little light on setting assessments, and it creates a culture of the association living in scarcity. And you're absolutely right that every dollar someone makes is hard-earned dollars, and there are expenses everywhere we look, and there's even new expenses, cable TV expenses, cell phone expenses, things that we didn't have years ago, and they just make it more expensive to live in this modern world of ours. But again, homeowner assessments are generally down there as one of the smaller expenses we deal with in our life. In my life, insurance expenses, mortgage, things like that are much larger. So it's something that we have to deal with, but I'm an advocate for, again, because it's the board is subject to the same assessments, it's not like they're charging other people and laughing all the way to the bank. I see a lot of hardworking boards out there that are trying to make ends meet, and I don't like the thought of them having such limitations. But I believe, and it's fortunate, that there's not too many associations out there that are still living with caps. So I don't believe it's a big issue.
Well, I think it's a good thing, and I think all associations should have caps. Because the other thing that that we don't seem to talk about a whole lot is fraud, embezzlement, theft, and all of that. And that seems to be on the rise. So
yeah, as long as we have humans, there's going to be temptations for humans to do the wrong thing with money or resources that aren't theirs.
So you end up with seniors on fixed incomes being assessed more money to cover the theft and the embezzlement.
Right, that's true, but again, fortunately, that's still pretty rare.
I don't know. I hope you're right, Robert.
Yeah.
I hope you're right.
Shoot, I believe that bad news is prevalent. Like, I just read that there was a shooting in Miami, and I'm in Los Angeles. Why should I know or care about a shooting in Miami? Now, if I was in Miami, I should care. But there's a lot of bad news that gets widespread attention, and I trust and I believe that fraud and embezzlement is still something considered rare. But that's probably a better question for a guest of yours in the insurance industry, not a reserve study professional.
Well, you know, if you just look at the stories, I mean, we seem to hear of embezzlement stories coming out every single day. And some people have got lists and lists of them. One of the biggest ones was over $2 million from a number of associations right here in Virginia. So, I mean, a few years ago. The only reason he got caught and the only reason anybody in the government decided to do anything is because the guy went on a shooting rampage and decided to try and shoot a cop. And they didn't like that so much. So then they discovered...
Don't blame them.
They discovered $2 million. But, you know, if you call the police and say, hey, we think there's been this embezzlement, sorry, hands off, it's not our problem, it's your problem. So.
Yeah. Well, again, fortunately, at this point in time, my understanding is there's about 350,000 associations out there. And if we're talking about a few, then that's still something that we consider rare. But, of course, that's point of view, and we're lucky to have someone like you that raises the news of that, and so we're all aware, and perhaps we can be appropriately defensive.
That's, you know, the only I don't raise that because it's in my opinion, it's fairly commonplace. It may be, you know, it may only affect a small percentage of all associations, but when you look at the numbers, it's a disgrace. It's an absolute disgrace. But anyway, I want to know.
We digress.
I want to know.
This is a good conversation for your next insurance guest.
You know, that's a good point. We'll have to do that. But I want to know what advice you would give to board members, associations, management companies, managers, on how to make the money they have stretch, how to best budget the money they have. I know you say you're not into the regular budget portion of
operational
it.
Operational budget.
The operational budget, thank you. Sometimes the words just seem to fly away. But you're more into the assessments. How can people do a better job? I mean, it's got to be a formula.
Well, it's not necessarily a simple formula, but even, I think it was yesterday, I received a sales letter from a local community association painter. I'm on his mailing list, and he was talking about how the treasurer out this one association he has submitted proposals to for the last 5 or 6 years has gradually been climbing from a $200,000 painting proposal to about a $350,000 painting proposal because he drives by and he sees the deferred maintenance. And turns out that that paint job that should have been $200,000 is now creeping up to be, it's going to be well over $450,000 due to all the deferred maintenance. So from what I see, timely execution of reserve projects does two things. It minimizes the extremely expensive deferred maintenance costs, and it maximizes home value. So there's a double whammy positive effect when you execute projects on time. Specifically, and again, this is in my world. This is the world of reserve studies. When you cross your fingers and wait too long to replace a roof, you end up getting very expensive water damage. When you cross your fingers and wait too long to seal or resurface your roads, you get very expensive remove and replace. When you wait too long to redo your windows, again, you get internal moisture damage. The bottom line is the costs of deferred maintenance are huge, and the small money that you save by being optimistic and not executing the project on time is usually overwhelmed by the larger expenses due to the larger scope of work and just plain resulting in higher costs. And so one of the ways they can control expenses is by doing their projects on time. That keeps the projects limited to the original scope, and especially in the area of reserves where the projects are generally large, you don't want those projects getting 25% or 50% larger because you waited a year or two. There's so many associations I could talk about that figured, let's stretch the painting a little bit longer, and instead of being $1 a square foot painting, they're now doing $10 to $15 a square foot siding replacement. That is what boards can do, is focus on taking care of the property and not minimizing the cash that they or the checks that they write. I think that's a wonderful thing they can do to minimize expenses and keep their budgets in check.
So you're sort of touching a little bit on one of my pet peeves.
And
uh-oh. And that's not something that you're responsible for, but construction. I look at construction. I mean, this area is just, you know, every parking lot's being torn up and there's a condo building that's being put in there, or a new walkable community, or a new whatever in there. But when you look at it, Robert, the structures are going up literally in days, and it's just junk. It's absolute and utter junk. They're building with what I call toothpicks. They're wrapping it in cardboard and sticking it together with scotch tape. And this construction is being approved. And that's not going to last quite as long as something that's built better. I mean, you're talking about this paint job that needs to be done. And then ultimately, by not doing it, you're going to have to go through the siding. Why don't we have something that's going to be constructed properly that's not going to need to be replaced?
That's a good question. I don't have a good answer on that. I do know that it is common for a new association that has ironwork that, let's say, the average interval for ironwork repaint is 5 years. What we see in a lot of new construction is the ironwork needs to be painted after it being only a year or two old, because the initial factory coating was very thin, was marginal. So, yes, our country's tolerance for quality coming out of factories and new construction is lower than it has been, but hopefully that'll be reflected in sales price. And although it may look really cool, it's going to be expensive to maintain. And that's just where we get back to, it costs a lot of money to maintain these associations, and you need an effective budget so you're not always thinking that, we can't afford to paint. And by thinking you can't afford to paint, then all of a sudden you can't afford to re-side. And that's shooting, my mom would say, now you're starting to shoot your foot. So we have to be real careful that we're taking good care of the property that we have and dealing truthfully with the expenses that are generated just due to normal deterioration. Normal deterioration is inevitable. There's nothing we can do about it. And it's up to the board to gradually collect the funds needed over time so you don't get hit with that dreaded special assessment.
Thank you for pointing a lot of this out. I'm beginning to see that we seem to have a lot of different issues that are coming together under just one umbrella. And if you go back to why we have associations in the first place, which is to give local municipal governments a free pass on the taxes. So they're collecting their full share of taxes, and they're not providing the services that those taxes were designed to do. So the associations are dealing with it. Now they've sort of loosened up on the building requirements. And literally, Robert, million-dollar houses are junk. I mean, I'd much rather live in my old house, because although it's nothing spectacular, it's built better than the garbage that's being built right now. And I'll stop sometimes and take pictures of these, what looks like toothpicks, and the paper that's wrapped around there that's supposed to be a moisture barrier with great big holes in it, flapping in the wind. And then they'll just slap some plastic over that and charge you $1 million for it.
Yeah. Well, there's no doubt, and the evidence will show, there's plenty of poor construction out there. I live in a house that is, I think, 27 years old, and I expect that it would behave very differently if it was a house that was 2 or 3 years old.
Yes.
And there's nothing I can say to challenge that, just the truth of the world that we live in. So, yes, there are challenges, and that's, again, comes back to there's going to be ongoing inevitable costs of deterioration, and some of these million-dollar homes are sold with roofs that really only have about a 15-year life cycle, not a 25-year life cycle, because the developer was motivated to sell. They wanted a particular price point, and, again, good for them. Their motivation is to make money just like anyone else, but the association needs to be able to collect. They need someone to stand by their side and say, you know, you have a 15-year roof on there. You can't really be waiting to start reserving for replacement. It's going to happen sooner rather than later. And recently we've, well, so that is a reality of the world that we live in.
And standing next to the homeowner, you just bought something that's garbage and you need to start saving money to replace that. Why don't we go back to our local municipal governments? I mean, they're charging and issuing permits, building permits, and they're doing absolutely nothing. There's no inspections, there's no nothing. And so you end up with homeowners who have to replace everything very, very quickly on this million-dollar home that they bought that they fell in love with. And then you have Robert who comes along and says, hey, you know, you just bought something that's not worth a bean and you'd better start collecting money and preparing to replace it. There's something really, really wrong with that, Robert.
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't say it's not worth a bean. It's worth $1 million because that's what they paid for it. But they need to appreciate that they have a 15-year roof and the asphalt was thin and the paint was thin. And it's just going to continue to be expensive to maintain. That's just the nature of the house. And just like there's some cars that are more expensive to maintain than others, and you have to pay more money for a higher quality car. And I think we need to wait a few more years for there to be a grading system for homes the way we see grading systems for restaurants and so many other things in our world that we enjoy.
Should housing consumers be getting a better deal? Because right now it looks like they're being fleeced from everywhere.
Well, you're getting out of my area of expertise. I know, but my expertise is reserves, and I see a lot of homes being sold that are, I want to say, used homes, not brand new construction. And so I think the general population in the United States is still buying older homes. The new construction is a new entry to the market. The new construction is, as you and I both know, due to the numbers, largely in community associations. It's more cost-effective to build in quantities. We see that in Walmart and Kmart and big-box stores. It's just cheaper to do it in bulk. But it is expensive to maintain these, and we just need to make sure that the boards serving and trying to meet the needs of the association have a free hand and are knowledgeable enough to know how to take care of it and keep the home value high. And I'm sure you've had some attorneys on your show that are the backup plan, because when something really is egregious, then they can call their attorney and hold the developer or the contractor's feet to the fire and get the roof fixed or the siding fixed or the balconies fixed or whatever is literally incorrect at the association. There's a lot of attorneys out there that are association's best friends.
Well, yeah, you have the construction defect attorneys, and but so many states have enacted legislation that sort of limits it. And as you said, if you've got a 15-year roof and the defect legislation sort of stops. There's a drop dead date of 3 years. That's not going to help you. You're still stuck with having to come up with a whole new roof.
Yeah, well, it's an imperfect system, but we do have some checks and balances, and I get called upon to help when there's a reserve issue involved in a construction defect squabble. But yes, it's an imperfect world that we live in, Shu, and I don't think that surprises any of us.
No, and you're right. It is, and it's getting more and more imperfect as far as I can see.
Well, that's why we need to be diligent, and you need to have this radio show, and I need to continue to help my clients.
Well, I'm glad you're helping my listeners as well, because I think this is an important conversation that we're having here. On your website, Or when I called earlier, there was a message. Talks about reserve legislation. Let's talk a little bit about that. Is there legislation that affects reserves across the country? Are the state governments requiring reserve studies or a certain amount of funding? Or what's the deal that's going on there? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, it's basically consumer protection legislation. It's the same type of legislation that requires us to wear a seatbelt when we drive. It doesn't prevent accidents, but it protects us when the inevitable occurs. So on our website, we have a list of legislation across the states. It's all state by state. And I think we're now up to 27 states that are requiring either some form of reserve study, either for budget purposes or for new homeowner disclosure purposes. To the best of my knowledge, there's only one state, and that's Hawaii, that requires a certain level of funding. Every other state legislation, again, to my knowledge, has to do with some type of disclosure and information so the homeowners and prospective buyers can get an insider's look at how the corporation, literally the corporation of the association, is doing. And from the reserves point of view, it's almost like answering the question, how well is your pension fund doing? We're able to say with a percent funded, or that's how it reports, have prior boards set aside adequate reserves to keep up with deterioration, or are you likely going to get hit with a special assessment? It's all very measurable. Most special assessments are predictable years in advance. You can see them coming. It's like a slow-moving freight train. If the board hasn't set aside enough funds, then the special assessments are going to occur. So the legislation is out there. It's generally good consumer protection legislation. There's only one state where the legislation uses different words than National Reserve Study standards, so that makes it a little bit confusing. But generally it's in the best interest of both the association and the homeowners and I'm a strong advocate for transparency. I think you use the word sunshine.
Yes.
Transparency. Boy, that is such a good thing. Everyone's a member of the association. They deserve to see the truth of the matter.
Yeah.
And having that kind of information out there is only a good thing.
So many associations just want to hide all the financial information. They don't want you to see it. And that is so wrong, because it is the homeowners who are ultimately going to have to pay for that. And
right.
They need to know what's going on and what the board is doing. So all of this hiding the banana is just a really bad thing, in my opinion. Robert, years and years and years ago, and I'm going back and I'm throwing this at you, there was an article after one of the hurricanes, and I think it was in Hawaii. And in the article, Money Magazine or someone said gave a quick and dirty formula in terms of what a homeowner could expect, or what a housing consumer could expect, just by looking at the health of the budget. They talked about a percentage of the entire budget. If the reserves were, let's say that the entire budget was $100,000, then if you have a 10% budget, $10,000 saved in reserves. So it's a quick and dirty, without going through all of the actual components in the association. Is there something that's a quick and dirty that people can just look at
There's two parts of it: how much they have in the reserve fund, the savings account, and how much they're actively transferring into the reserve fund. I see reserve expenses as an ongoing cost. We call it the ongoing cost of deterioration, because every day, every week, every month, the roof is getting older, the paint is getting older. It's an ongoing cost. So I think it's helpful to characterize reserve expenses as ongoing monthly expenses. What we find in our clients as we look at literally at the facts, is that to be setting aside enough reserves on an ongoing basis, they need to be setting aside anywhere from 15 to 40% of their total budget towards reserves.
Wow.
Fundamentally.
Up to 40%?
The cost of ongoing deterioration is large. The I believe it's FHA and Fannie Mae have at this point in time set a number of 10%. That's a nice floor. So they want to see reserve contributions be at least 10% of an association's total budget. In our experience, again, it needs to be somewhere between 15 and 40% to be adequate to prevent an association from inevitable special assessments. As far as a rule of thumb for how much cash needs to be in reserves, I don't know of such a rule of thumb. It's a continually moving target when you look at cash, because if you look at a 100-unit association the year before they do a roof project, they need to have a lot of money in the bank. The year after they do a roof project, you would expect them to have a lot less in the bank. The same is true for a painting project or a elevator modernization project or an asphalt project. So the amount of cash an association has fluctuates greatly from year to year. So it's very difficult to have a rule of thumb. And that's why the percent funded is such a valuable measuring tool, because it measures the cash in reserves compared to the needs of the association. So that's a nice stable number through the years. What we see is associations that are 70% funded and above very rarely experience special assessments. It's the associations that are in the 0 to 30% funded range that regularly have special assessments. And then that's because years and years of board members, again, whether lack of knowledge, lack of courage, or pursuing the wrong objective, they just haven't been setting aside, or limiting governing documents, they just haven't been setting aside enough funds towards reserves. But figure of merit, if I have a quick answer for your listeners, to be appropriately funded, the majority of associations need to be setting aside 15 to 40% of their budget towards reserves. I'm not greedy. It's not going to me. I'm just telling you the facts. That
wouldn't you like it to go to you, right?
What's that?
I said, wouldn't you like it to go to you?
Well,
I would.
It'd be nice to take a half a percent. No, that's hardworking board members, volunteer board members saying, oh, darn, the roof is going to be $100,000. Hopefully we have at least $100,000 in reserves. And hopefully over the last 20 years they've been collecting a little bit of a time over all the owners who enjoyed that $100,000 roof. So figures of merit, it's easier to report on reserve contributions rather than reserve fund balance.
You talk about 15 to 40%, and a lot of the examples you've been giving, like roofs and elevators and painting, and those seem to be geared more towards condominiums. And so I'm going to guess, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Robert, I'm going to guess that the 40% is more for condos and the 15% would be more for HOAs, where the homeowners take care of their own painting and their own roofs, and, you know, we don't have elevators. And so it's a different dynamic, basically.
Shu, I hear you, but we divided, we have a large data pool of numbers. We've done over 45,000 reserve studies all across the country. Our data pool, since we've been collecting, is up to about 30, 35,000 data points. We divided that by association type, high-rise, mid-rise, townhome, plan development, homeowner association, timeshares, and other exotics. We divided it by East Coast versus West Coast. We divided it by metropolitan versus suburb. And Shu, I had different people in my office come double-check my work because I couldn't believe it, but they all came out almost identically the same.
Really?
The common denominator is they're all volunteer board members who have the same resistance to and the same decision-making process to raising or stabilizing assessments from year to year to year. And I live in a plan development, a homeowners association. So the total income, the homeowner assessments are much lower, fundamentally because of the type of association I belong to. But the expense ratio is surprisingly consistent, whether it's a homeowner association townhome, mid-rise condo, high-rise condo. As you go up the scale, the expenses are larger, the income needs to be larger, but the ratio is surprisingly similar.
Well, I'm surprised to hear that because, you know, I would have thought, you know, in the single-family homes and the townhouses, because I live in a townhouse, but there's no, you know, the association doesn't own or do anything to my particular property. It's like a single family. I mean, the old row houses, you never had an association.
Right. But again, your homeowner assessments are low. And in my homeowners association, I think we have about 600 homes. I should know that, but I don't. And we have a clubhouse, pool, spa, and two tennis courts. And so out of those low homeowner assessments, we're still paying for common areas. We just have 600 people to share it amongst instead of that clubhouse, pool, spa, tennis courts being shared by, you know, 45 condominium owners. It's still the same ratio. It's just lower numbers spread over a whole lot more people.
Okay. That makes sense when you sort of explain it that way. My favorite question, do we need to have all of these associations? I know that local municipal governments like them because they get to tax us and not have to do anything. But realistically, do you need an association where you live?
That's a good question. We needed a home close to where our kids were going to go to school. That was the driving factor. And so we looked and looked and looked, and being in the community association industry, I was against, and my wife will tell you that quite honestly, I was against living in a community association. I'd live it all day. I didn't want to live in it at night. And we bought this nice home in a planned community. It's not gated, has public streets, but as I indicated, has a nice recreation facility. We don't use it. We have a pool in our backyard, but it costs me $150 a quarter or roughly $50 a month. That's just the cost of living there. So do we need it? Well, I don't need it, but they provide a consistent set of architectural standards. Our next-door neighbors, again, we're here in California, our next-door neighbors wanted to take out their water-hungry grass and put in a synthetic grass surface. And they put in their architectural change permit, and it was rejected by the association because they were proposing a low grade of artificial grass. The association made them use a higher grade of artificial grass. I still think it looks like plastic. I want to go over there and putt on their front yard rather than it doesn't surprise anyone. The grade that they chose still looks like plastic. I have been in some neighborhoods, high-end neighborhoods, where I'm in this world. I had to walk up and feel it because it looked so real. So there's good things you can do. And our association protected my wife and I from our next door home looking, let's say, too cheap. And so in some ways it's good. We went into it eyes open, and silly me, my silly story of becoming involved in an association is that soon after we moved in, we wanted to paint the house and do the normal fix-up things the new homeowners do. And we had an interior designer help us with the inside of the house, and she gave us a real good color palette, and we extended that to the outside of the house. And she put big swatches of paint on our garage door, which is immediately facing the road. You can probably see where I'm going here. And I said, I like number three best, and we painted our garage doors with paint color number three. And, of course, what did I get in my mailbox the next day?
Yep,
a letter from the association saying we had used the non-approved color. And I said to myself, well, what a fool am I? I work in this industry. I know about associations. I know about architectural controls. That's one of the things we could benefit from in this association. And the first thing I did within the first month, I broke a rule. Anyway, fortunately, the management company knows who I am. We do reserve studies for the bulk of their associations. I threw myself on the mercy of the court, said, yeah, I am so sorry. I'm Robert Nordlund. You know who I am. I made a terrible mistake. The asterisk, though, is that the color was recommended by our interior designer. I beg of you to consider that it does look good. While clearly it is unapproved, it does look good. And once you know, a month later I got a note saying the board has taken your advice and we've added that color to our approved color palette. Go and sin no more. So
cool.
I breathed a sigh of relief after I got through that one. But do we need it? That's an interesting question. I have young adult children, and they are at a stage where they're wondering. They're both renting. And they're wondering, what are they going to do? Will they buy something in a community association? Will they buy a freestanding home? It's interesting for me to watch and see what their decision process is, having been raised in a home where Dad worked in the community association industry. I think that just the economic nature of it is fundamentally cheaper to buy a home within a community association where there's bulk purchasing of things like elevators and swimming pools and clubhouses and exercise rooms than it is standalone. And until the economics change, I think it's going to be just a fact of life here in these United States.
So you said you don't use a lot of the amenities that you have over there.
That's correct.
If you wanted to, why not have another company? I mean, a private company whose job and business it is to have a pool, and you could join it like you would a country club.
I am a member of a tennis and swim club. It's almost right across from the office, and it's where I go to exercise in my normal lunch hour. So, yes, the resources are there. There is a tennis club a couple miles away from where I live, so anyone who wanted to... Actually, that's a very good point. I investigated membership there at one point in time, and I think membership is about $50 a month, which is, as I told you, about what we pay for homeowner assistance.
Right.
And so it's quite possible people can do that, and that way they have their own choice, but that's in a planned community. We have about a little over 2 miles worth of trails, lighted trails through our community. I'm not much of a walker on the trails. I tend to drive a couple of miles and hike through the hills. But there's some nice amenities that if I was a slightly different person, I would enjoy very much. And so it's an interesting balance that developers got to strike to say, what amenities are going to be cost effective? Well, I believe we're seeing that fewer and fewer golf communities are coming up. I see the rise of, what do we call it, farm communities, agro communities, which I think are fascinating.
Yeah.
So the developers are on top of it. They're trying to give the buying population what the buying population wants. And sometimes, like our community, it's better part of 30 years old. Back then, it came with a clubhouse, pool, spa, and 2 tennis courts.
I had Wayne Hyatt on before I started this show, I had another radio show beforehand. And he said that the use of common elements was way down. I mean, people were not using pools or tennis courts or anything, and that was back about 19 years ago. So, yeah. But you know what, Robert? We are out of time, and I want to thank you so much for coming on and doing this. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Well, shoot, it's been a pleasant conversation. Always it's always a treat.
And I learned a lot from you, and I'm hoping that a lot of my listeners did too. Gave us a different perspective. And we're still having to open our wallets wider, but thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, you're welcome. Community associations are a fact of modern day living, and we do our best to, here at Association Reserves, help them have an improved future. And we all need people like you to keep the communication lines wide open.
Thank you, Robert.
Please check out our website at onthecommons.us. On the Commons is produced by OTC Multimedia Productions.
Well, I finally bought my dream home to enjoy retirement life. I've made new friends and buddies, lots of parties for my wife. It seemed that life was perfect, all my neighbors felt the same. Then along came death by CCRs, life's over, I'm fair game. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Now there's lots of open meetings close to justice for HO. Those arrogant board members say what they want you to know. The CAI and ULI will help you lose it all. But I wouldn't sell that dream home yet, the writing's on the wall. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Well, we're not afraid or stupid, all your threats mean nothing here. Time marches on, soon you'll be gone, united we'll be there. So put your rules and CCRs up where the sun don't shine, and enjoy those precious golden years, stop messing around with mine. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell.